in his flagship, Lorient, on 19 May 1798. His first objective was Malta. The island had been in the possession of the Order of the Knights of St. John since 1530. The knights had conscientiously maintained their hospital and had heroically withstood the dreadful Turkish siege of 1565. But as fighters for Christendom, they had grown soft. When Bonaparte reached the island on 9 June and sent messengers ashore to the Grand Master, a German named Ferdinand Hompesch, to demand the admission of all his ships into the harbor to take on water, he received a reply stating that, according to the regulations of the order, states that were at war with other Christian countries might send in only 4 vessels at a time. A message was returned swiftly from Lorient. General Bonaparte is resolved to obtain by force that which ought to have been accorded to him by virtue of the principles of hospitality, the fundamental rule of your order. At dawn on 10 June, the assault on the island began. The 550 knights, nearly half of them were French, and many more too old to fight, resisted for only 2 days. On the morning of the 12th, they requested a truce. That same night, a delegation came on board the flagship. The order would give up its sovereignty over Malta and Gozo, so long as the French government used its good offices to find Grand Master Hompesch some small principality to which he could retire, together with a pension of 300,000 francs to enable him to live in a style that befitted his rank. Napoleon accepted and immediately set to work on a program of reform. In less than a week, he managed to convert the island into something tolerably like a French département. The people were ordered to wear the red, white, and blue cockade. Slavery, such as it was abolished. 600 Turks and 1,400 Moors were to be repatriated. The number of monasteries was reduced, and the power of the clergy drastically restricted. All gold and silver was to be removed from the churches, and all the treasure from the Palace of the Knights, which included the famous silver service regularly used by the order to feed the sick in the hospital, melted down into 3,500 pounds of bullion for Napoleon's war chest. 3,000 French soldiers under General Claude Vaubois were left behind to provide a garrison, and within a week of its arrival, the fleet was ready to continue its journey. On the 19th, Napoleon himself set sail. France, however, was not to keep the unhappy island for long. In 1800, enraged by the behavior of Vaubois, who had even tried to impose French as the official language and who now proposed to auction the entire contents of the Carmelite Church in Mdina, the Maltese, led by their clergy, rose in revolt, hurling the French commander of militia out of a window. Vaubois quickly ordered all his men to Valletta, where he locked the city gates. Thenceforth, the French found themselves under siege. Meanwhile, the Maltese appealed to the British Navy for help, and several ships arrived to blockade any French vessels that might attempt to relieve their garrison. These were followed shortly afterwards by 1,500 British troops. Vaubois held out heroically until, thanks to the blockade, he had only 3 days' rations left. He was then allowed an honorable surrender and safe repatriation for the garrison, taking with him, to the further fury of the Maltese, who were not consulted, much of the treasure that his men had looted during their stay. With the departure of both the knights and the French, the Maltese found themselves under the authority of a British civil commissioner, until such time as their long-term future could be settled. In 1802, the Treaty of Amiens, which declared peace between Britain and France, although Napoleon intended to observe it only for as long as it suited him, provided for the return of the island to the Order of St. John. The Maltese, however, who had no more love for the knights than they had for the French, let it be known that their own strong preference was for the security afforded by the British crown, which by the Peace of Paris in 1814 they were finally to obtain. On the night of 1 July 1798, nearly 2 weeks after its departure from Malta, the French fleet dropped anchor off Marabou, some 7 miles west of Alexandria. The landing of so many men and so much equipment in the small boats, which were all that was available, was a long and complicated task. It began only in the late afternoon when a storm was already brewing. The Vice Admiral, François-Paul Brouillet-Dagayet, had advised delaying the operation until the following morning, but Napoleon had refused to listen. He himself did not reach the shore until shortly before midnight. Fortunately for him, there was no resistance until the army reached Alexandria, and even there, the crumbling walls and the tiny garrison could do little to delay the inevitable. The whole city proved to be in a state of advanced decay, its population reduced from the 300,000 that it had boasted in Roman times to a sad and apathetic 6,000. Apart from Pompey's Pillar, which had nothing to do with Pompey, and Cleopatra's Needle, which had no association with Cleopatra, there was nothing to evoke its days of glory. To the French army, therefore, the capture of Alexandria came as an anticlimax. The July heat was demoralizing enough, but men who had expected a rich and magnificent city, with commensurate opportunities for pillage, and who had found only a heap of pestiferous hovels, felt not only disappointed but betrayed. Napoleon saw that they must be given no time to brood, but must march at once on Cairo. Advancing along the western side of the Nile Delta, they captured Rosetta without a struggle, and on 21 July met the main body of the Mameluk army at Imbabe, just below Jazeera Island. Napoleon's exhortation to his troops, "Think, my soldiers, from the tops of these pyramids 40 centuries look down upon you," has gone down in history, but was hardly necessary. The Battle of the Pyramids was a walkover. Mameluk swords, however valiantly wielded, were no match for French musketry. The following day, he entered Cairo, to his men a slight improvement on Alexandria, but scarcely a vaut le voyage. Nelson, meanwhile, had been pursuing the French ships across the Mediterranean. Misled by information from a Genoese vessel that Bonaparte had left Malta on 16 June, 3 days earlier than he actually did, he had hastened to Alexandria. Then, finding to his astonishment no trace of the French fleet, he had sailed again on 29 June to search for it along the coast of Syria. As a result of this confusion, it was only around 2:30 p.m. on 1 August that he returned to Egypt, to find 13 French men of war, he himself had 14, and 4 frigates anchored in a 2-mile line in Aboukir Bay, one of the mouths of the Nile. But they were still 9 miles away. It would take another 2 hours to reach them, and a lot longer still to draw up his own ships in a regular line of battle. Night encounters in those days were hazardous things. There was a danger of running aground in unknown waters, and a worse one of firing into one's fellows by mistake. Most admirals in such circumstances would have elected to wait until morning. Nelson, however, seeing that the French were unprepared and that there was a favorable northwest wind running, decided on an immediate attack. He began by sending 4 ships inshore along one side of the French line, while he himself and his flagship, the Vanguard, led a parallel attack down the offshore side. Each enemy vessel was thus subjected to a simultaneous cannonade from both sides. That was at about 6 o'clock. The ensuing battle lasted through the night. By dawn, all the French ships but 4 had been destroyed or captured, including their flagship, L'Orient, on which Admiral Brouillet had been killed by a cannon shot. The vessel still lies beneath the waters of Aboukir Bay, together with all the treasure looted from the palaces and churches of Malta. The Battle of the Nile, as it was called, was one of the greatest victories of Nelson's career. At a stroke, he had not only destroyed the French fleet, he had severed Napoleon's line of communication with France, leaving him marooned and frustrating all his plans of conquest in the Middle East. His victory also had a serious effect on French morale, though not apparently on Bonaparte's. Almost before the ship's guns had cooled, Napoleon was at work transforming Egypt into a strategic base. What the British were attempting to achieve little by little in India, he set himself to complete in a few months. He devised new and more efficient systems of administration and taxation. He established land registries. He gave orders for hospitals, improved sanitation, and even street lighting. The scientists and engineers whom he had brought with him were put to work on such problems as purification of the Nile water and the local manufacture of gunpowder. Where he failed, unsurprisingly, was in his attempts to win the trust and support of the Egyptians. He did his best, taking every opportunity to stress his admiration for Islam. He even issued a proclamation to the people of Egypt, in which he seemed to go still further. "I, more than any Mameluke, worship God, glory be to him, and respect his prophet and the great Quran. O ye sheikhs, judges, imams, tell your nation that the French are also sincere Muslims." The fact remained, however, that his men were living off the country and behaving as if they owned it. Small-scale revolts were constantly breaking out, with attacks on isolated French garrisons or individual Frenchmen in the street. A more serious uprising in October was put down with brutal efficiency. Over 3,000 Egyptians were killed and the entire Al-Azhar quarter sacked, including its mosque. From that day forward, Napoleon decreed that any Egyptian found carrying a firearm was to be beheaded and his body thrown into the Nile. It was no wonder that the longer the occupation continued, the more detested it became. Beyond the Egyptian frontiers, too, enemies were gathering. On 2 September 1798, the Ottoman Sultan Selim III declared war on France, and the Turkish governor of Syria, Djezzar the Butcher Pasha, began to raise an army. This could easily march south, then turn across the Sinai Peninsula and invade Egypt from the east. Worse still, it could be carried by English ships straight to the Nile Delta. Rather than risk such an eventuality, Napoleon decided to act first, to destroy Djezzar's army even before it was fully formed. In early February 1799, he marched his men across the deserts of Sinai and up into Palestine. On 7 March, Jeddah fell. 2,000 Turks and Palestinians were put to the sword. Another 2,000 taken down to the sea and shot. In an effort to improve his image after these atrocities, the commander-in-chief visited a plague hospital and, we are told, was ill-advised enough personally to carry a plague victim out to his grave. He was not infected. Otherwise, this exercise in public relations does not seem to have been outstandingly successful. Acre was his next objective, but Acre was well defended and well garrisoned, the Turkish commander having enlisted additional support from the British Navy under the swashbuckling Commodore Sir Sidney Smith, famous for having escaped from the Temple prisons in Paris during the Revolution. Smith had brought with him his friend, Colonel Philippieux, a military engineer who had been at the École Militaire with Bonaparte and who was able to contribute invaluable expertise to the defense of the town. For 2 months, the French army besieged the city. Fortunately, however, Smith had succeeded in capturing the 8 gunboats carrying their siege artillery, stores, and ammunition. Napoleon had only his field guns, and it was not until 25 April that he was able to bring up 6 heavy cannon from Jaffa. On 10 May, he launched his final assault. Like its predecessors, it was thrown back with heavy losses, and he had no course but to retreat. By this time, plague had taken hold in the army. He himself advocated killing all the patients with overdoses of opium, but his chief medical officer refused outright. The hundreds of stretchers carrying the sick and wounded considerably slowed the return journey. It was a miserable body of men that finally limped back into Cairo. As always, Bonaparte did his best to dress up defeat as victory. Turkish prisoners were paraded, captured Turkish flags proudly displayed. What was left of the army, cleaned up as far as possible, staged a triumphal march through the city and on 25 July made short work of a Turkish force which, with British assistance, had been landed at Aboukir. But no one, least of all the Egyptians, was fooled. The Middle Eastern expedition had been a failure, and had done little for Napoleon's reputation. He was alarmed, too, by reports reaching Cairo that Europe was once again at war, that the Italian Cisalpine Republic, which he had established 2 years before, was now under Austrian occupation, that the Russian army was on the march, and that the domestic situation in France itself was once again critical. For the first time in his career, but not the last, he left his army to get home as best it could, and at 5 o'clock in the morning of 22 August 1799 slipped stealthily from his camp and sailed for France. Not even his successor in command, General Jean-Baptiste Kléber, knew of his departure until he was safely away. In Paris, the coup d'état of 30 Prairial, 18 June 1799, had expelled the moderates from the Directory and brought in men who were generally considered to be Jacobin extremists. But confusion continued to reign, and one of the new directors, Emmanuel Seyès, declared that only a military dictatorship could now prevent a return of the monarchy. Je cherche un sabre, he said, I am looking for a saber. That saber was soon to hand, and from the moment Napoleon arrived in Paris on 14 October, having almost miraculously escaped the British fleet, he and Seyès started planning a coup of their own. It took place on 18-19 Brumaire, November 9-10, abolished the Directory, and established a new government, the Consulate. There were technically three consuls, but effectively only one. The first consul, Napoleon Bonaparte, was henceforth master of France. He spent the winter reorganizing his army, and Russia, having by now withdrawn from the anti-French coalition, preparing for a campaign against his principal remaining enemy, Austria. At that moment, the Austrians were besieging Genoa, capital of one of his more ephemeral creations, the Ligurian Republic. A lesser general would have marched south from Paris and down the valley of the Rhone. Napoleon turned east at the Alps and took his men over the great St. Bernard Pass before the snow had melted, appearing in Italy behind the Austrian army and taking it entirely by surprise. The Austrian general, Michael von Miles, had no course but to leave Genoa and regroup, concentrating all his forces on Alessandria. Napoleon followed them, and on the evening of 13 June 1800, reached the village. It was, in fact, little more than a farm of Moreno, some 2.5 miles southeast of the town. The encounter that followed might have spelled the end of Napoleon's career. Milas did not wait to be attacked. The following morning, with a force of some 31,000, he lashed out at the 23,000 French, pounding them remorselessly with his 80 guns for over 5 hours. In the early afternoon, their line began to give way. They were forced to retreat nearly 4 miles to the village of San Giuliano. The Austrians' victory seemed certain. Strangely enough, however, perhaps because the 71-year-old Milas now retired to Alessandria, leaving the command to some relatively incapable subordinate, their pursuit was slow and half-hearted, giving Napoleon time to regroup and to welcome substantial reinforcements under General Louis Dissay, which just then, providentially, arrived from the southeast. As evening drew on, he launched a counterattack. Dissay was killed almost immediately, but his 6,000 men, fresh and rested, gave new spirit to their fellows, and by nightfall the Austrians were in full retreat. When the battle ended, they had lost 9,500 men, the French less than 6,000. Milas now had no choice but to come to terms, withdrawing all his troops east of the river Mincio and north of the Po, giving the French complete control of the Po Valley as far as the Adige. Napoleon, his reputation unstained despite the narrowness of his victory, returned to Paris, where he took over both the military and the civil authority. In 1801, Austria was forced to sign the Treaty of Lunéville, whereby France regained the old frontiers that Julius Caesar had given to Gaul, the Rhine, the Alps, and the Pyrenees. Napoleon's star was now high in the sky and was still rising. Chapter 22. Neapolitan Interlude. The news of Nelson's victory on the Nile was received with jubilation in England, but still more so perhaps in Naples. Its king, Ferdinand IV, had come to the throne in 1759 at the age of 8. He and his queen, Maria Carolina, daughter of the Empress Maria Theresa of Austria and elder sister of the unfortunate Marie Antoinette, were an ill-assorted couple. Ferdinand, the scoundrel king, as he was universally known, Il Re Lazzaroni, was a childish boor who loved only hunting and horseplay, possessed not a shred of natural dignity, and boasted of never having read a book. The queen was comparatively intellectual, acutely conscious of her rank, yet surprisingly tolerant of her insufferable husband, to whom she was to bear 18 children. Though herself only 16 years old at the time of her marriage, it was not long before she was effectively running the kingdom, her foreign policy being dictated by her understandable detestation of the French Revolution and all it stood for. Ever since 1797, to Maria Carolina, to her subjects, and even to King Ferdinand, French intentions in South Italy had been only too clear. In Rome on 22 December of that year, the local Jacobins staged an armed demonstration against the Pope, in the course of which a 27-year-old French officer named Léonard Dufaux was shot by a papal corporal. The French ambassador, Napoleon's elder brother, Joseph, refused to listen to the Vatican's explanations and reported to the Directrice that one of his country's most brilliant young generals had been murdered by the priest. As a result, General Louis Berthier was ordered to march on Rome. He met with no opposition and on 10 February 1798 occupied the city. 5 days later, the new republic was proclaimed in the Forum. Pope Pius VI, aged 80, was abominably treated. His rings were torn forcibly from his fingers, and he was carried off to France, where he was to die miserably at Valence in August 1799. What was Naples to do? The French were now on its very doorstep. What was to prevent them from crossing the frontier? And who could stop them if they did? With Napoleon's seizure of Malta in June 1798, the threat loomed still larger. No wonder that the Neapolitans rejoiced at the news of the Battle of the Nile, or even that when Nelson himself arrived on his flagship Vanguard towards the end of September, he was accorded a hero's welcome, with, on the 29th, a magnificent 40th birthday banquet for 1,800 guests, given at the Palazzo Cesa by the British minister Sir William Hamilton and his wife Emma. But the party, as far as Nelson was concerned, was not a success. On the following morning, he wrote to Lord St. Vincent, "I trust, my lord, in a week we shall be at sea. I am very unwell, and the miserable conduct of this court is not likely to cool my irritable temper. It is a country of fiddlers and poets, whores and scoundrels. I am, etc." Indeed, the next 3 months were a nightmare. The Austrian field marshal, Baron Karl Mack von Liebrich, arrived in early October to assume command of the Neapolitan army of 50,000 men, who duly marched north, a quivering king among them. Needless to say, they proved quite incapable of stopping the French advance, and by early December, more and more of them, officers and men alike, had shed their uniforms and returned to their homes. The queen, her sister's dreadful fate always in her mind, wrote several times to Lady Hamilton deploring their cowardice, but when her husband deserted in his turn, there were no more letters on the subject. On 18 December, there arrived a dispatch from an utterly demoralized Mack, confessing that his army, which had not yet fought a single battle, was now in full retreat, and imploring their majesties to leave while there was still time. "I do not know," wrote Nelson to the minister at Constantinople, "that the whole royal family, with 3,000 Neapolitan emigres, will not be under the protection of the king's flag this night." And indeed it was, though, thanks to atrocious weather and the usual Neapolitan confusion, The vanguard did not leave Naples until the evening of the 23rd. On Christmas Eve, Nelson recorded that, "It blew harder than I have ever experienced since I have been at sea. On board, there was general panic. Of the distinguished passengers, only Emma Hamilton kept her head. Sir William was found in his cabin with a loaded pistol in each hand, since, he explained to his wife, he was determined not to perish with the guggle, guggle, guggle of salt water in his throat. Little Prince Albert, aged 6, died of exhaustion in Emma's arms, but at 2 in the morning on the 26th, the vessel finally dropped anchor in the harbor of Palermo, and a few hours later His Sicilian Majesty made a formal entry into his kingdom's second capital. The king and queen settled as best they could into what passed for the royal palace. Nelson, meanwhile, moved in with the Hamiltons. He was desperately tired and not yet completely recovered from a head wound sustained at Aboukir Bay. He was quarreling with the Admiralty, and his relationship with his wife was also giving him cause for serious concern. He desperately needed emotional support, and Emma Hamilton gave it to him. Her long experience as a courtesan did the rest. It was in Sicily that their celebrated affair began. When the French troops under General Jean-Étienne Championnet arrived in Naples in mid-January, they found the populace a good deal more spirited than the army. The mob, the so-called Lazzaroni, was prepared to attack the invaders tooth and nail, and for 3 days there was bitter house-to-house fighting. In the end, the Lazzaroni had, of course, to give in, but not before they had stormed and gutted the royal palace. They had done so with a clear, or almost clear, conscience. Had not their king abandoned them? And besides, would he not have preferred his treasures go to his own subjects rather than to his French enemies? When at last peace was restored, a French officer remarked that if Bonaparte had been there in person, he would probably have left not one stone of the city standing on another. It was fortunate that Championnet was a moderate and humane man. Quietly and diplomatically, he established what was known as the Parthenopean Republic on the French Revolutionary model. It was officially proclaimed on 23 January 1799 and acquired a number of loyal Italian adherents, though it was perfectly obvious to all that it had been the result of conquest and that the French army of occupation was its only support. To Queen Maria Carolina, life in Sicily was worse than death. She and her husband, she believed, had been dishonored and disgraced. The winter of 1798-99 was perishingly cold, with snow on the ground, a rare phenomenon in Palermo. The royal apartments possessed neither fireplaces nor even carpets. The news of the sack of the royal palace in Naples had caused her deep distress. Worst of all, perhaps, her husband had turned against her, blaming her for forcing him into that shameful campaign and for saddling him with the hopeless General Mack. But her spirit was undaunted. She dreamed only of counter-revolution and enthusiastically welcomed a proposal for just such an operation, despite the fact that it came from a most improbable quarter. Cardinal Fabrizio Ruffo was already over 60. He had been papal treasurer to Pope Pius VI, but in Rome, all his suggested reforms had been rejected as too radical. He had consequently retired to Naples, from where he had duly followed the court to Palermo. He now proposed a landing in his native Calabria, first to defend it from any further French advance, as well as from Italian republicanism, and ultimately to recover Naples for its king. This would, he emphasized, be nothing less than a crusade, and he had no doubt whatever that all his fellow Calabrians would rally to the cross. Ruffo landed as planned on 7 February with 8 companions. 80 armed Lazzaroni joined him almost at once, and by the end of the month, the strength of the Christian Army of the Holy Faith had risen to 17,000. He was a born leader and quickly won their love and trust. In 1799, wrote his secretary, biographer, Saccianelli, "There was not a miserable peasant in all Calabria but had a crucifix on one side of his bed, a gun on the other." On 1 March, the cardinal was able to establish his headquarters in the important city of Monteleone. Catanzaro followed, and then Cotrone. Admittedly, he had his problems. His ramshackle army was totally without discipline, his crusaders comporting themselves no better than their medieval predecessors. Cotrone, for example, was delivered over to a sack from which it never recovered. Such atrocities could not but damage his reputation, though he personally was mild and merciful, always preferring peaceful conversion to violence. But his momentum was unstoppable, and his successes encouraged other similar movements throughout South Italy. He himself, having recovered the whole of Calabria, marched eastwards into Apulia, where he had similar success. By the beginning of June, he was at the gates of Naples, which, thanks to a blockade of the bay by a British fleet under Rear Admiral Sir Thomas Trowbridge, was by now on the brink of starvation. On 11 June, hearing of the cardinal's approach, the people of Naples broke out in open rebellion. There was fighting throughout the city. Desperate for food, mercilessly bombarded by the French from the St. Elmo, Nuovo, and Ovo castles, the Lazzaroni fell on every Jacobin they could lay their hands on, French or Italian, with unbridled barbarity. There are accounts of unspeakable atrocities, of dismemberment and cannibalism, of severed heads paraded on pikes or kicked around like footballs, of women suspected of Jacobinism being subjected to ghastly humiliations. The horrified cardinal did what he could, but many of his own men had plunged joyfully into the bloodbath. In any case, against mob hysteria, he was powerless. The orgy of destruction continued for a week. Negotiations were seriously impeded by the inability of the commanders of the three castles to communicate with one another, and it was only on the 19th that the French formally capitulated, St. Elmo alone still holding out. Even then, there were problems. The king and queen, and of course the Hamiltons, insisted that no mercy be shown to any of the Jacobin survivors, while Ruffo and his friends saw all too clearly the danger of bringing home a royal couple who thought only of revenge. Nelson, understandably but most unfortunately, took the monarchist side. Politically, he was extraordinarily naive, his knowledge of the situation in Naples being limited to the highly tendentious opinions that he had picked up from the king and queen and the Hamiltons. He spoke not a word of any language but his own. As a down-to-earth, right-wing English Protestant, he mistrusted the cardinal, and on his arrival in Naples had no hesitation in overruling him, insisting, as his friends also insisted, on unconditional surrender. Some 1,500 rebels whom Ruffo had saved from the mob and to whom he had given refuge in the municipal granaries marched out according to the terms of the capitulation, expecting safe conduct to their homes. They were seized by the new royalist government, and many of them were executed. Was Nelson guilty of betraying them? Probably not. All that we know of his character suggests that he would never knowingly have done such a thing, but the Hamiltons' influence was paramount, and he always accepted their point of view. He has also been condemned, with a good deal more justification, for his treatment of Commodore Francesco Caracciolo, the former senior officer of the Neapolitan Navy, who had transferred his allegiance to the Republicans. After 10 days on the run in disguise, Caracciolo had been found hiding in a well and was brought before Nelson on the Fadroyant. At 10 in the morning of 30 June, he was court-martialed. At noon, he was found guilty of high treason and condemned to death. And at 5 in the afternoon, he was hanged from the yardarm. There his body remained until sunset. It was virtually midsummer. When the rope was cut and it fell into the sea, he had been allowed no witnesses for his defense, no priest to hear his last confession. His request to be shot rather than hanged was refused outright. Traitor he may have been, but he had deserved better than that. Why had Nelson allowed it? Simply because of his infatuation with Emma. With a ship and the ocean beneath him, he was invincible, infallible. On land, he was literally out of his element, and when in the arms of his mistress, little better than a child. Leaving Maria Carolina in Palermo, the king returned to Naples in the first week of July, but he did not stay there long. Never during his 40 years on the throne had he believed that he had enemies in the city. Now he knew that he did, and the knowledge had shaken him to the core. Henceforth he preferred the safety of Palermo, where he could still fool himself that he was popular. On 8 August, he sailed back into its harbor with Nelson on the Fadroyant. The queen came on board, and the two together then made their formal disembarkation to the salute of 21 guns before driving, in state, to a Te Deum in the cathedral. For Ferdinand and Maria Carolina, for the Hamiltons, and for Nelson, life now continued much as it had before, except that there was no longer any cogent reason to stay in Palermo. The queen yearned for Naples. The king, on the other hand, had worked himself up about it until dislike had turned to detestation. Never, he said, would he willingly go back. The Hamiltons, while from the political point of view advocating return, were in fact perfectly content where they were. Sir William, being accredited personally to Ferdinand, was required to remain with him, and Naples may well have held poignant memories since his second collection of Greek vases had been lost in a shipwreck in August 1798. The saddest fate was Nelson's. He was to remain ashore in Palermo until June 1800, 10 months in which his infatuation with Emma Hamilton not only sapped his morale, but even seems to have affected his conscience and his sense of duty. For the first half of that period, he was acting commander-in-chief, Mediterranean, but he left virtually all the work to his subordinates. He was not there to intercept Napoleon Bonaparte when he slipped out of Egypt. Had he made the effort and succeeded, history might have taken a very different turn. His colleagues grew increasingly concerned for him, and disturbing reports even reached London, where the Admiralty began to lose patience, and the First Lord, Lord Spencer, very nearly relieved him of his command. In January 1800, his superior, Lord Keith, returned to duty and ordered Nelson to join him in an inspection of the blockade at Malta. But the Admiral returned almost at once to Palermo, where Emma, now shamelessly pregnant, received him publicly with open arms. He and the Hamiltons were back in Malta in April 1800, though their voyage savored more of a pleasure cruise than a serious naval visit. At that moment, Sir William received his letters of recall. So finally, in July, all three of them sailed for England. Since Keith had refused Nelson a battleship, he commandeered ships from the blockade of Malta without permission, taking with them on the first leg of the journey Queen Maria Carolina, who was on her way to visit her family in Vienna. They landed her at Livorno, where they ran into General Sir John Moore on his way to Egypt. It is really melancholy, he noted, to see a brave and good man who has deserved well of his country cutting so pitiful a figure. The Hamiltons finally settled in London, where Nelson's daughter, Horatia, was born the following January. On the very same day, he was named second in command of the Baltic Fleet, an appointment which very probably saved his reputation and his career. Chapter 23. Egypt after Napoleon. When Napoleon slipped so ignobly out of Egypt in August 1799, he left his deputy, Kléber, in an impossible position, and perfectly furious. The army's morale after the long and abortive Syrian expedition was lower than ever. Many of its soldiers were sick, food was scarce, drinkable water scarcer still. Kléber managed, however, to negotiate an armistice with Sir Sidney Smith, by the terms of which his army would be returned to France at the expense of the Sultan and his allies. It must have seemed almost too good to be true, and so indeed it proved to be, since both parties were blatantly disobeying orders. As Kléber well knew, the First Consul had given clear instructions that the army was to remain in Egypt until the signature of a general treaty of peace, while Smith, desperate to get the French out of the country, had similarly ignored an equally explicit order from London, that no terms were to be made which did not involve the surrender of French troops as prisoners of war. Not surprisingly, the Commander-in-Chief, Mediterranean, Lord Keith, flatly refused to approve the document. Meanwhile, the Turkish Janissaries were once again on the march. Kleber had no choice but to put his men once again on a war footing, and conclusively proved that there was life in them yet. On 20 March 1800, he defeated the Turks at Heliopolis, and a month later accepted the surrender of the Cairo garrison. By this time, the British government had decided, after all, to ratify Smith's armistice, but these last successes had put a very different complexion on such matters. However ailing and homesick the French army might be, it was now back in control. To most of its senior officers, evacuation was no longer an issue. One of the few who still had his doubts was Kleber himself, but on 14 June, the very day of Moreno, he was assassinated in Cairo by a Muslim fanatic, to be succeeded by the pompous and pot-bellied General Jacques, or as he now preferred to be called, Abdullah Mignot. Mignot had recently converted to Islam, largely, it was thought, the better to enjoy the companionship of an Egyptian wife, daughter of a bathhouse keeper in Rosetta, of which town he had formerly been governor. Though reasonably brave and not unintelligent, he was sadly deficient in judgment and, in short, a bit of a joke, by no means the man to shoulder the responsibilities that lay ahead. With Austria finally off his back, Napoleon's thoughts had returned to the Nile. The great affair now, he wrote to his brother Lucien in December 1800, is Egypt, to inspire the troops there with a sense of their important mission. Egypt was the bridgehead, the springboard, the gateway to the East. The old dream was revived, of a glorious expedition from Suez, which would sweep through the Red Sea and, perhaps in a single campaign, drive the British from India forever. He, Napoleon, would then be master of his own mighty Oriental realm, a latter-day Alexander the Great. Meanwhile, in England, the same dream assumed the form of a nightmare, and there were those who took the danger very seriously indeed. Among them was the head of the War Department, Henry Dundas, a dour Scottish lawyer, of whom his chief, William Pitt, had declared that his comprehensive knowledge of the history of India, though it might have been equaled in the House, had never been excelled. It was plain to Dundas that the only solution lay in a preemptive strike, and equally clear that this strike should be carried out by the British force of some 22,000 men, under his kinsman and fellow Scotsman, General Sir Ralph Abercrombie, then stationed at Gibraltar. Its purpose would be not to occupy Egypt, but quite simply to get the French out. Dundas had a hard time persuading some of his colleagues, King George III himself, remembering all too well the American War of a quarter of a century before, gloomily predicted that any army sent to Egypt would perish of starvation or disease or both. But at last, with Pitt's strong support, the decision was taken. Abercrombie was now 66. He was a man of the highest integrity, who had already refused a peerage and a grant of land in the West Indies. He had resigned a command in Ireland on a matter of principle, and had avoided service in America because of his sympathy for the rebels. He had, however, fought in the Low Countries and the Caribbean, where in 1796 he had commanded the largest expeditionary force ever sent abroad, and despite fearsome epidemics of malaria and yellow fever, had recovered several important islands, including Trinidad, from the French. His most recent operation, an attempt in October 1800 to destroy the Spanish fleet and arsenal at Cadiz, had been a fiasco. The British troops had failed even to make a landing. The principal fault, however, had been that of his superior, Lord Keith, and a sudden tempest of almost tropical violence had done the rest. Abercrombie had reached Gibraltar with his pride seriously hurt, but his record untarnished. Though he was naturally determined that the coming Egyptian campaign would restore his reputation, he had no delusions as to its difficulty. He possessed no wagons or beasts of burden, few cavalry, and still fewer teams of artillery. Nor did he have a single map of the region. The French, thanks to their professional surveyors, by now had whole sheaves of them. Water, too, would be a problem. The British would almost certainly have to depend on the Navy for their supplies. Theoretically, he should have invaluable support from the Turkish Army. But Major General John Moore, whom he sent on a fact-finding mission to the Turkish headquarters at Jaffa, returned to report that the Turks were poorly provisioned, utterly undisciplined, and commanded by an elderly one-eyed Grand Vizier who was devoid alike of qualities of leadership and of military knowledge. The British would be better off on their own. The combined naval and military force assembled during the winter of 1800-01 at Marmaris, on the coast of Asia Minor. At dawn on 22 February, Admiral Lord Keith gave the order to weigh anchor, and for the next 10 hours the fleet, numbering no less than 175 vessels, sailed one by one out of the bay. "Never was the honor of the British Army more at stake," wrote Abercrombie's son, Robert, from the deck of HMS Kent. But an equal number of Britons never assembled who were more determined to uphold their own and their country's valor. On 2 March 1801, the fleet hove to in Aboukir Bay. But by now the weather was steadily deteriorating, and it was another week before the sea was calm enough for a general disembarkation. Thanks to assiduous practice in Marmaris, this was finally effected on the 8th, with some 13,000 infantry, 1,000 cavalry, and 600 artillery all being landed in a single day. The French were waiting for them, but Maignot, who had persisted in believing that the Aboukir landing would be merely a diversion, had kept the main bulk of his army in reserve in Alexandria, and sent off a subordinate, General Louis Friant, with just 2,000 men to oppose the invaders. Friant, with 3 iron cannon and a dozen field guns, was confident in his ability to deal with a ragged line of boats and small parties of men struggling ashore as best they could. But the intensive training to which the British troops had been subjected at Marmaris had not been for nothing. Ignoring the French fire, Moore led them fearlessly in parade order up the beach, where they quickly formed a line, fixed their bayonets, and charged. The French, hopelessly outnumbered, turned and ran. Nonetheless, the British losses that morning were heavy. The army lost 625 men, the navy nearly 100. Enemy casualties were somewhat fewer, but there was no doubt as to the result of the battle. It had been the most spectacular success against the French that anyone could remember, and the British soldiers' coolness and courage under fire had been beyond praise. They had won, and won heroically, their first foothold in Egypt. Morale soared. They looked forward to the future, as well they might. Abercrombie, however, advanced down the peninsula to Alexandria, only with the greatest caution. March on the city he must, but the terrain was unfamiliar, and the French were unlikely to make the same mistake again. His column was attacked on 13 March and again on the 18th. But these engagements proved to be only minor skirmishes. Just 3 days after the second of them came the moment of truth. The Battle of Alexandria began at dawn on Saturday, 21 March, and lasted for the next 4 hours. Both sides fought with courage, their generals, except Maignan, setting a superb example to the men under them. Of the French, General François Lanus, killed in battle at the age of 29, was perhaps the bravest, but also one of the most clear-sighted. To Maignan, who rode up and spoke to him as he lay dying, he remarked simply that he was foutu, like Mignot's entire Egyptian colony. Of the British, Moore was once again the hero of the hour. Early in the fighting, he had been seriously wounded in the knee, and soon afterwards had had his horse shot under him. But he had fought on in a manner described by an eyewitness as almost beyond belief. As for Abercrombie himself, in the early stages of the battle, he had been hit by a musket ball that had lodged in his hip. The doctors were astonished at the way he had continued to move about the battlefield. Only after the fighting ceased did he allow himself to be laid on a stretcher. A junior officer picked up a soldier's blanket and put it as a pillow under his head. "What's that?" he muttered. "Only a soldier's blanket," the officer replied. "Only a soldier's blanket?" he echoed. "A soldier's blanket is a thing of great consequence. Return it to him at once." A week later, he died. His successor, Major General John Healy Hutchinson, was as much disliked in the Army as Abercrombie had been loved, to the point where a number of senior officers actively plotted his downfall. They would probably have succeeded, but for determined opposition on the part of the still convalescent Moore. Healy Hutchinson's colleague, Sir Henry Brunbury, who knew him well, wrote, "He was 46 years of age, but looked much older, with harsh features, jaundiced by disease, extreme short-sightedness, a stooping body and a slouching gait, and an utter neglect of his dress. He shunned general society, was indolent, with an ungracious manner and a violent temper." From the start, the Major General found himself in a difficult position. The British had won another victory, so much was certain. They had inflicted some 3,000 casualties on the French at a cost of 1,400 of their own. But Alexandria remained in enemy hands, held not by a small and demoralized garrison, but by the bulk of the French army of Egypt, still probably more numerous than his own, under a commander-in-chief who had no intention of leaving. Nor could that army be starved out. The road to the west was wide open. Little effective help could be expected from the Turks. There was always the possibility that the French would themselves take the initiative, but Mignot seemed bent on playing a waiting game. Something clearly had to be done to break the stalemate, and Healy Hutchinson at last decided to send a small force of 2.5 battalions, plus 4,000 recently arrived Turks, to attack Rosetta on the westernmost branch of the Nile Delta. The expedition was a success. The garrison at Fort Julien lay down its arms on 19 April after a 3-day resistance. The way was now clear for shipping on the Nile, and possibly even for a major river operation. On the other hand, such an operation would seriously deplete the garrison, which would have to be left outside Alexandria. And it was to protect this, and also to cut Mignot's line of communication, that Healy Hutchinson now decided to flood the dried-up Lake Mareotis immediately to the south of the city. The canal dike was cut in two places, and the waters of Lake Aboukir plunged down in 10-foot cataracts, carrying away 300 feet of the banks. Leaving his deputy, General Eyre Cooch, to hold the front at Alexandria, Healy Hutchinson set off on 21 April for Rosetta, and on 5 May, headed up the riverbank towards Cairo. The march took 7 weeks, weeks during which the exhausted men, many of them sick with dysentery, were obliged to contend with 110-degree temperatures by day and monstrous spiders and scorpions by night. There were several skirmishes with the French along the way, but also, surprisingly, an unexpected meeting with the Turkish army, which, to everyone's surprise, had somehow marched under its one-eyed Grand Vizier from Jaffa, defeating a French force en route. "It was the worst army that ever existed," wrote Healy Hutchinson. "But, bad as they are, they will fight to a certain degree in their own pay." On 7 June, there was a violent sandstorm, but when it cleared, there on the horizon were the pyramids. By the 21st, the last units had arrived, and the British and Turks together had Cairo effectively surrounded. Unfortunately, Healy Hutchinson now had only some 4,000 soldiers fit for duty. The Cairo garrison, he had learned from French prisoners, amounted to about 5,000, although their morale was said to be low. In the event, it proved even lower than he had been led to believe. On 22 June, the day the batteries were to be drawn into position, the gates of the city opened. The siege of Cairo was over before it had begun. General Augustine Daniel Belliard, commanding the Cairo garrison, had had little choice. There were less than 2 months' rations in the city, and foraging was no longer possible. Ammunition, too, was desperately short, down to 150 rounds per gun. His men had no stomach for the fight. All they wanted was to get home. He also had to remember the local population, who had no love for his army, and who would not hesitate to rise up against it when they saw the chance. There might perhaps have been a hope of retiring into Upper Egypt and continuing the resistance there, but another British force from India was rumored to be on its way to Qusair on the western shore of the Red Sea, from which it would advance on to Cairo from the south. Most worrying of all was the realization that his commander-in-chief had gone off his head. Just a week before, a courier from Alexandria had delivered a letter from Mignot, describing how he had reported to Bonaparte that the British had suffered appalling losses on their way from Rosetta. Belliard himself, according to the same report, had destroyed the Turkish army and was now advancing down the Nile towards Alexandria. Meanwhile, reinforcements from France were on their way. Cairo must be held until they arrived. To the luckless general, it was now clear that he could no longer hope for any reasonable orders from his chief. Henceforth, he was on his own. Having no authority to make terms, he summoned a council of war. It was only after assuring himself of the support of his senior officers that he sent one of them, under a flag of truce, to report his readiness to negotiate. An armistice was agreed at once, the capitulation signed on 28 June. The French, with their arms, baggage, and artillery, would march under British escort to Rosetta, where they would be shipped back to France within 50 days. During the ensuing period of well-deserved rest and recreation for the British, and for the French of preparation for their coming departure, Healy Hutchinson arranged for officers and men alike to visit the pyramids. Several of them, according to contemporary accounts, cut their names into the stone. Sergeant Daniel Nickel wrote in his journal, "I wrought very hard and got D. Nickel 92 REGT carved, and broke my knife while finishing the job. This is in the southeast corner and is likely to stand some time." Few, mercifully, seem to have shared the enthusiasm of a certain Colonel Cameron of the 79th, who, in his eagerness to carry home a souvenir, ordered one of his men to attack the royal sarcophagus with a sledgehammer. For the citizens of Cairo, 9 July 1801 was the worst day that any of them could remember. It was the day when the French evacuated the city and when it was engulfed by swarms of Turkish soldiers, who had made no secret of the fact that the unrivaled prospects of murder, rape, and pillage which it offered were the sole reason for their having crossed the deserts from Syria. The Grand Vizier's army had always been cheerfully anarchic. Now, as the orgies and the bloodbaths began, the last faint suggestions of discipline vanished. There was nothing the British could do as they formally took over the garrison. The Turks were their allies and had given plenty of warning of their intentions. As for the French, who had withdrawn to Giza, they can have felt nothing but relief to be out of the city at last. British, French, and Turks together set off down the Nile on 14 July. The British were astonished to find that the French numbered not the 5,000 that they had estimated, but nearly three times that number. They were accompanied by some 300 small riverboats carrying the sick and wounded with the baggage, vast quantities of loot, and the corpse of Kleber, to be buried under an appropriate memorial in France. 3 weeks later, on 5 August at Rosetta, their embarkation was complete. On the 9th, the last ship sailed for Toulon. Now, finally, the British could turn their full attention on Alexandria, and so, they very much hoped, draw a line under the whole Egyptian adventure. Throughout the journey to the coast, the army was commanded by Moore. Healy Hutchinson, having fallen sick, spent most of July recovering at Giza. Only on the 29th did he arrive by river at Rosetta, where he immediately boarded the flagship Foudroyant and remained there for another fortnight. It was essential that he should properly regain his strength before marching on Alexandria, and in any case, no major operations could begin until Moore had finished supervising the French embarkation. By then, however, the major general had his plans ready. He would attack the city simultaneously from east and west. It lay at the center of a narrow isthmus separating the Mediterranean to the north from the recently flooded Lake Mareotis to the south. From Rosetta, some 40 miles east of Alexandria, he would advance with his heavy artillery. Coote, meanwhile, would be shipped with 3 brigades across the lake and take up a position on the isthmus some 8 or 10 miles beyond the city to the west. In a classic pincer movement, the two would then come together. The attack began in the evening of the 16th when, under cover of darkness, some 300 gunboats carrying 4,000 men sailed westward over Lake Mareotis. Then at dawn on the 17th, 2 divisions under Moore and General Sir John Craddock advanced along the isthmus and attacked the advanced French positions.